Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Tanya Mosley, and I want to thank you for listening to the Here and Now podcast. I also want to ask you to do something. Support your NPR station with a donation right now at donate.npr.org/now. Your contribution supports the reporting you hear every day, the latest from Washington, where a new administration is preparing to take over, and reporting from across the country on the surge of COVID-19 cases. Your donation ensures that you're hearing a range of voices, the experts, and also the everyday people who are experiencing all of this right now, like we all are. You're also helping to make possible those unforgettable interviews with authors, big thinkers, and creatives in the fine arts and popular culture. Those moments that make you want to listen every day. So make a donation to your NPR station now. Your contribution is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Congress is expected to work into the weekend to try to hammer out a deal to help people struggling financially during this pandemic. And Republicans and Democrats seem to agree on a couple of things: a limited extension of unemployment benefits, some help for small businesses, and direct payments of at least $600 for most Americans. On the Senate floor today, Missouri Republican Josh Hawley called for doubling that to $1,200.
What these Americans ask for is not for government to solve all their problems. It's not for government to give them a handout. It's a chance to get back on their feet.
One major sticking point has been federal assistance to state and local governments facing budget shortfalls because of this pandemic. And joining us now to talk more about this is the mayor of Louisville, Kentucky, Greg Fisher. He's also the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and he's a Democrat. Mayor Fisher, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Mayor, it looks like there'll be no direct money to cities and states in this deal. Make the case. What is the need in your city right now?
Well, it's immense here in Louisville and cities all over the country right now. All along, this response to the pandemic was supposed to be federally supported and state mandated and then locally executed. So here we are where we see the vaccine in sight, and we're coming up short with no funds to locally execute that. So what that means is our budgets at the city levels all across the country have been ravaged by this pandemic. And about two-thirds of a normal city budget consists of public safety personnel. So to balance budgets without any type of relief we're getting in right now means that we're going to have to impact the very public safety officials that we rely on more than ever right now. So it's just a travesty, and we're encouraging Congress to stay at the table, find the will to involve local governments with this response and direct fiscal stimulus that's so badly needed right now.
Are you looking at layoffs or cutting social services?
That is going to be a very real ramification for cities around the country right now. So when you think about the EMTs, EMS workers, police workers that make up most of the budgets, they are in very real threat right now. And the social services, the amount of food insecurity that we have right now, the people that we're helping with eviction relief, none of that's going to stop on December the 30th. So it's critically important that this relief is included in Congress's response that they're working on at this very moment. I would encourage everybody to call their U.S. senators and encourage them, keep cities in this stimulus bill.
Some states are doing better than others. California has a one-time tax windfall because it has higher property taxes on the wealthy that were hurt less during this pandemic. While Texas is hurting because of falling oil revenue, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he doesn't want what he describes as a blue state bailout. Here he is last Friday on the Senate floor.
Democrats are acting like it's more important to supply the governor of California with a special slush fund than to help restaurant workers in California keep their jobs. Oh, and by the way, these demands for state and local government giveaways are blocking urgent aid for struggling families at a time when many states' tax revenues have largely gone up.
Mayor, is this a matter of blue versus red states?
This is not a blue state, red state issue, blue city, red city issue. You can see What this is a time to put all kind of partisanship aside. Over 1.3 million state and local workers have already lost their jobs. And what we learned in the Great Recession was that because of the non-funding of local and state governments, it took us 2 years longer to come out of the recession than what it should have. So we need not only to keep these jobs at the local and state government level, but we got to think about the services that are being provided in terms of public safety, public health work. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about direct relief for state and local governments.
I hear what you're saying about this not being a partisan issue. Just 12 of the 50 largest U.S. cities are led by Republicans, though. Your city, Louisville, ranks 29th. What are you hearing from Republican mayors? Are they in line with Republican members of Congress in opposing direct aid to their cities?
No, mayors have rallied around the need for aid because mayors are in the reality business. So we see the pain in our cities. There's unanimity in terms of the mayors that we have to have the support that we can so that we can locally execute the solution here to the coronavirus. And the irony, of course, is we're closer than ever before with the vaccine now being administered around the country. So now is not the time to hold back. It's the time to invest to make sure that we can get the vaccines in the right place at the right time, get our country out of this nightmare that's been COVID-19.
Mayor, you voiced concern about another idea that's been floated. It's this one-month extension of a federal eviction moratorium that expires at the end of the month. Isn't a one-month extension better than no extension if you want to help people who are struggling at this moment pay their rent and stay in their homes?
I think you want to ask, you know, what's the role of government? And it's to provide a platform for human potential to flourish. And certainly while a one-month extension of eviction is better than no month, you got to be thinking further ahead than that because the economy is not going to be recovered 1 month from now. I just implore Congress to find the skill and the will to get this done right now. The time is critical.
Greg Fisher is mayor of Louisville, Kentucky, and president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Mayor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you.
The Navajo Nation began distributing the COVID-19 vaccine this week in the midst of a second deadly surge and a strict lockdown order. The vaccine represents a glimmer of hope for Navajo healthcare workers. It's been a feat to make sure it's distributed and stored properly, even in the most remote areas. The Navajo Nation is the biggest reservation in the U.S., an area larger than West Virginia. It stretches across Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico. The person in charge of the vaccine program there is Dr. Loretta Christensen. She is Chief Medical Officer of Indian Health Services, Navajo area. Dr. Christensen, welcome.
Thank you.
As we mentioned, the Navajo Nation is an enormous area. How difficult is it to get the vaccine to all the people, and tell us how many people there are in the region and what the challenges are in getting it there?
We had an excellent distribution team. We did a lot of logistics and planning, and our emergency management incident commander created a plan with four distribution teams so that we could get the vaccine in a timely fashion to each one of our healthcare facilities. The furthest one being almost 4 hours away. We had the escort of the Navajo Police Department to make sure we were able to make our way through in a timely fashion, and we got it done. We know our area very well. Many of us are from the Navajo Nation or the border towns, and we travel along these roads all the time. It is quite challenging because there aren't many ways to get to each of these facilities. There's one main route that we have to take, but we certainly did a lot of pre-planning, and it worked out extremely well. We were able to get everybody their vaccine on Monday or Tuesday, so we're very, very pleased.
That means how many people have received it?
We are over 1,000 of the doses have been given, and we anticipate the remainder will be done by Sunday afternoon. We, of course, have to catch the different shifts of healthcare workers. And we've been very efficient with this process. So I have to say I'm very grateful to everyone on the vaccine teams at every facility for being so well prepared.
There has been a historic mistrust between the federal government and Native communities. And I wonder if you're hearing from frontline workers how and whether they're having to deal with that mistrust and whether people are comfortable getting vaccinated.
Well, it's unfortunate that there is that historical trauma that we're dealing with. But we've been extremely proactive, and I feel one of the issues over time has been adequate and impactful communication. So we have really taken the time to get the word out to the public, to have forums where the public could ask us questions. We've been very transparent about this process all along, that we're watching the vaccines. We feel they're safe. They're going to help us. We don't want you to get COVID. We're all messaging very positively. And this includes all leadership, from President Nez to the head of IHS, to the upstanding members of the communities in Navajo that are speaking up. Our medicine men are speaking up. They're saying, we need you to get this. We need you to protect yourself, your family, your friends in our community. So we're messaging in a way that this is going to be very helpful for us. This will help us stop this surge that we're in right now. And we don't want to lose any more of our people. We've had a tremendous loss, and we're still grieving over all those losses. So we want to move forward with a very positive attitude that this vaccine is here to help us.
You just created an interesting image there of medicine men encouraging people to take this cutting-edge vaccine.
Yes, we're very fortunate that we have some very strong traditional practitioners that are associated with our healthcare facilities and hospitals. So they work side by side by our healthcare workers every day. And I think there is a very trusting and respectful relationship established to where they understand what COVID has done to our Navajo people. So they're very passionate about healing. They're very passionate about their communities. So one of the first people on Navajo that got the vaccination was a traditional practitioner from one of our hospitals. And he spoke very eloquently to the public that he believes this is here to help us, that we have to use what we're given.
Dr. Loretta Christensen, Chief Medical Officer of the Indian Health Services Navajo area, thank you so much.
Thank you.
How does a country that suffered searing conflict survive? How do the people of Rwanda, Cambodia, Northern Ireland, and Lebanon pull the pieces together and even thrive? That's the inspiration behind a new multimedia project called Imagine, Reflections on Peace. Gary Knight is one of the editors of the project. He is an acclaimed photographer and co-founder of the Seven Foundation, which produced the book that's part of the project. Gary, welcome.
Thank you, Lisa. Great to be here.
We're also joined by Robin Wright. She's a longtime foreign correspondent and writes for The New Yorker. She wrote about the wars in Lebanon and life there now for this project. Hi, Robin.
Great to be with you.
Gary, let's start off with you. What were the threads that you felt the need to pull together for this project?
Well, after working so much in war zones during the late 1980s through to the mid-2000s, you know, I realized that although peace was the main objective in any war that I covered, when I look back at all of these stories that I covered, peace seemed to be somewhat disappointing, and peace hadn't, in fact, delivered what the populations of the countries I've been working in had expected. So the idea when we started the project really was to just go out there and examine why and understand, you know, how one could make a better peace.
How one could make a better peace, and you say that process largely goes undocumented. So how did you go about documenting it? Talk about the reporters who covered it then and you sent back out again now.
So we sent people back to Cambodia, to Rwanda, Lebanon, Bosnia, Northern Ireland, and a team to Colombia, which when we started the project was still a very fresh peace process. And it was very important for us to assign photographers and writers who had decades of experience, not only covering the wars, but covering the aftermath.
One of those reporters and writers that you sent out was Robin Wright. And Robin, I wonder if you can tell us, you had lived in Lebanon for 15 years. There, we can't even call it a war in Lebanon. It was actually a combination of wars. And you went back to talk to the people after the bloodshed. And Assad Chaftari, I think it is. He fought for Lebanese forces, a Christian militia. And he told you, you met him at a Starbucks and talked about his time as one of the top intelligence officers. He said, my task was to decide the fate of those who were rounded up at checkpoints. He's talking about in the Muslim quarters of Beirut, and decide whether someone should be spared or exchanged or killed. A human being was little more than a product to me. This is a man who you say has a Christian education. He goes to church, goes to confession now, and finds some minor little thing to confess and says nothing about the killings. How did you make sense? How does he make sense of his history and what he was telling you?
Well, he used to go to confession and not talk about those who he killed, but he'd gone through an epiphany, partly because of his wife, who introduced him to a group of wives who were trying to bring their husbands together to get them to think about what they were doing. And he was one of those rare, rare people who was not only aware finally of the wrong he had done, but wanted to do something, and said he could never do enough to change or alter the evilness that he had engaged in. He started a group called Fighters for Peace, and they would go to high school because the war was not taught in Lebanon, still isn't. And they would go to high schools and talk to groups about how they used to try to kill each other. And he actually pulled together people he knew he was trying to kill, and how it destroyed their lives, their families, their country, their communities, and how it had to be put to a stop. But the lesson of Lebanon turned out to be that it is the individuals who are trying to create a different alternative rather than the state itself, which was not doing very much. And that was true. I lived in South Africa as well. You saw Desmond Tutu, who fostered the Truth and Reconciliation Committee to try to bring peace. But that's very rare in war zones. Countries coming out of conflict don't have the resources, the know-how, the tolerance, or the courage to do those kinds of things.
Gary Knight, could you talk to us about what happened in Rwanda? This is 1994, the genocide in Rwanda, and the issues at hand. And there are so many different issues, sectarian issues, territorial issues that can cause war. What happened to Rwanda then? And this is, I think, one of the most positive after-war stories that you have in the book.
Yes, whilst there are still pretty serious political problems, I think, in Rwanda, it certainly has been, I would argue, the greatest success, perhaps along with Northern Ireland, of the countries that we've looked at. And I think, as everybody knows, there was a very violent genocide perpetrated by Hutus against Tutsis in Rwanda. The country was completely broken. And at the time, I remember talking to colleagues. I was covering the war in Bosnia at the time. And if you had asked any of us which of the two countries, Bosnia or Rwanda, would have been the most successful now, two decades later, I don't think any of us would have thought that Rwanda would have been. But it has. And there are some, you know, key reasons why. The process of reconciliation, you know, truth and reconciliation, the Gacaca courts that were borrowed from South Africa have been instrumental in allowing people to move forward. And moving forward is critical. And the generation that lives through the war, if it doesn't process the war and move forward, it's very difficult for subsequent generations to do so. And the act of personal forgiveness, absolutely critical. And I think an issue that Robin touched on there when she was talking about the wives of warlords bringing their husbands together, the role of women in post-conflict societies is absolutely critical and has a major impact on the success of peace.
Yeah, there's a quote from the book, research shows that where women have access to power, war is less likely to break out in the first place. When you talked about the reconciliation, there are, and we should say this is a massive project that you embarked on here that includes videos. And in one of the videos from Rwanda, there is a photographer, Jack Picone, who had in 1994 illegally crossed the border to document the Rwandan genocide. He, 25 years later, returned wondering if the country could find light out of such horrific darkness that he had documented. And he spoke with a pastor who was there in 1994. Let's listen to this bit of tape.
I think most of us who survived, most of us we learned to sublimate the pain and the anger, because we were thrown into the rebuilding process, involved in reconciliation. But unless you handle it properly, it will come back to haunt you. So you simply learn to let it go.
So what comes through here is that there is peace in that in schools, for instance, kids who used to have to say in the same classroom, I'm a Hutu, I'm a Tutsi, they're not asked that anymore. Does that mean that there are no differences? Does that mean that they're able to live peaceably together? And we should say that Hutus and Tutsis, who were the Tutsis victims of some of the Hutu slaughter, are indeed living together side by side. What kind of a peace is that?
Yes, if you go to Rwanda now and you ask people about their ethnicity, they won't answer the question. But it doesn't mean that differences don't still exist. I think what's happened, though, in Rwanda is that people have understood how to patch over those differences, how to forgive, and how to move forward. And I think that's really, really critical to understand. And that's where Rwanda has been massively successful.
So just to summarize, and there's so much more to talk about, and we'll include much more on the website. I wonder if maybe, Robin, you can tell us if what the lessons are that you drew from your time there and going back now and talking to the people now about the nature of war and peace, a huge question, but particularly how people and how countries survive.
Well, the human spirit is, obviously, we are a species that struggles to survive, wants to survive, and biologically we're set up to make every effort to do so. But we also have, you know, other instincts, and sometimes we are not educated or knowledgeable enough to understand people who are different from us. And that leads to, in most wars, you know, some flashpoint that was not intended to start a war, but in fact does. And it was a shooting incident in 1975 that started Lebanon's war. And as we were putting this book together, the United States facing its own racial challenges and tensions. And I have thought often that how relevant this project is, not just to wars in other countries, but really to our own situation. And that peace is the best in the human spirit, but it is much harder than war, which involves some of the kind of primordial instincts. So the book was fascinating, both in understanding our times and the world and warfare, but it was also kind of a reflection of human history and the challenges we face in every country, not just in other places.
Very good to talk to you. New Yorker writer Robin Wright, photographer and editor Gary Knight, talking about the book Imagine, Reflections on Peace. You can see some of the photos from this multimedia project at hereandnow.org. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. For more than a century, a resilient city and region have relied on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve our most serious problems. The Foundation's work has been strengthened by hundreds of people who've left legacies to support our community. Leaving a charitable legacy at the Boston Foundation is a great way to have an impact now and in the future. Learn more at tbf.org/partner.
It's a monumental day on Wall Street. Tesla is poised to join the S&P 500. Traders are scrambling to sell $85 billion worth of Tesla stock by the close of the markets today before the electric car maker can join the stock index. Mike Regan's here to talk about it. He is senior editor at Bloomberg News. Help us understand, first off, Mike, this process of a new company becoming part of the S&P and all stocks having to be sold in one fell swoop.
So, Lisa, the most important thing to understand is how immensely popular what's called passive investing has become. And that's when a mutual fund or another type of investment vehicle simply buys every stock in the S&P 500 rather than picking and choosing among them. There's something like $4.6 trillion invested that way, including, I would guess, a lot of our listeners' 401k plans. So these funds are actually obligated to purchase shares of Tesla once it's added to the index, as opposed to an actively managed fund where the manager could pick and choose and decide whether or not to buy Tesla. What's weird is that stocks are added and removed to the S&P fairly frequently. But what makes Tesla so unusual is that the stock price had soared so much that it turned this company into like the sixth biggest company in the index once it's added. And that's because it didn't meet the index's eligibility requirements until this year, mainly the one where it had to be profitable over the previous year. So, Lisa, that makes Tesla actually the biggest stock by market value ever added to the index. And that's why it's such a big deal.
So when it joins the S&P 500, it has to knock somebody else out. It's going to replace apartment investment and management company, real estate investment trust that makes up just a small fraction of what Tesla is worth. What's the impact on the S&P of the entrance of a behemoth like Tesla?
So one thing about Tesla, it's a very volatile stock. The price swings quite a bit, and its valuation compared to its earnings is very high. It's a very, very richly valued stock. But the appeal of investing in the entire index at once is that you get that instant diversification among those 500 stocks. So Tesla is only going to be about between 1 and 2% of the index. So it'll have an effect on sort of the volatility of the index, but not a huge, huge effect. I think one of the main concerns today is that for these funds to buy all that Tesla stock, they have to sell an equal amount of everything else in the index. So there is some concern about selling pressure for some of the other stocks in the index, Lisa.
Briefly, Tesla's meteoric rise comes as tech stocks have emerged as one of the few winners this year amid the pandemic. How is it the company seemed to be rolling in cash when so many Americans are unemployed?
Well, I think, Lisa, one thing with the stock market this year is the Federal Reserve has kept interest rates at rock bottom to sort of spur the economy. And that's made the returns on offer in the bond market very unappealing to investors. And at the same time, if you were lucky enough to keep your job this year, you didn't have a lot of places to spend your income. So there's a big savings glut that I think is going into the stock market as well. Those two things are really pumping up the stock market this year.
Thanks a lot, Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Lisa.
States are receiving fewer doses of the coronavirus vaccine than they were initially promised, and they're now calling on the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to explain why. Washington State Governor Jay Inslee says the state's second shipment of Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine will be cut by 40%. For more, let's bring in Anna Boyko Ryrock, a reporter with KUOW in Seattle. And Anna, Pfizer says no vaccine shipments to states across the U.S. are on hold or delayed, and millions of doses are actually waiting to be sent out. So what's going on?
Yeah, I'd like to know that too, actually. So the state of Washington hasn't been given a clear explanation on this. And yesterday, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee said he's hoping it's just a communication issue, which will be fixed soon. Inslee was speculating that the different federal agencies involved in vaccine distribution are not talking with each other very well. And essentially, there was some mix-up or miscommunication somewhere along the line.
Pfizer's vaccine requires two doses per patient, and states are in the process of now giving out those first shots. So how are these shortages expected to impact the rollout of those first doses there?
Well, some hospitals were just starting to get word of what their allotment was for next week. At least one is putting its vaccination plans on hold for the moment. Overlake Medical Center in Bellevue, which was one of the first places to treat COVID patients in the area back when Seattle was the epicenter. They were going to get 975 doses and start vaccinations Monday or Tuesday. But now that's on hold and they don't know when they're going to get doses or how many. The Washington State Hospital Association says they're hopeful vaccine shipments aren't delayed beyond next week.
Mm-hmm. And how is the deployment of vaccines in Washington state more broadly going so far?
Well, they started out really slowly early this week. So you had just a handful of healthcare workers, just so hospitals could run through everything, sort of do a test run. And then within days, the hospital started vaccinating hundreds of people, you know, including this morning. So earlier this week, 17 hospitals received doses. And we know that at least 1,000 people have been vaccinated in the state so far. But it's probably a lot more than that because the data lags behind a few days. So far, hospitals haven't gotten enough doses to cover all their frontline workers, but a wide variety of healthcare workers and first responders are getting vaccinated. And it's really quite remarkable to see, actually. This week, I saw a Seattle firefighter get injected with the vaccine. He does testing for COVID at the city's free test sites. You have workers who are handling biological waste from COVID patients. You know, they're cleaning up hospital rooms after COVID patients. And these workers are now getting vaccinated. One guy who fits that category, I saw him get injected. He pumped his fist in the air after the dose went in. You know, you have healthcare providers in the ER who have to live with the uncertainty of this new patient who just showed up. Do they have food poisoning or do they have COVID? And this week I saw them get vaccinated and they said, this is a relief from that uncertainty.
Thank you so much for this update. That's KUOW reporter Anna Boyko-Wyrock in Seattle. Again, thank you.
Thank you.
The destruction of the world's largest rainforest continues with profound impacts on the world's climate. Satellite imagery shows more than 4,000 square miles of the Amazon has disappeared since last year in an area roughly the size of Jamaica. Organizations like Amazon Watch are shining a spotlight on the role banks and other financial institutions play in funding deforestation, with a particular focus on U.S. asset manager BlackRock. And for more, let's bring on Maura Burse. She's a climate and finance director with the nonprofit Amazon Watch. Welcome, Moira.
Thank you so much for having me.
Moira, this is the most logging the Amazon has seen in 12 years. What is driving this increase?
That's right. There's a massive increase in deforestation this year. And largely what's driving it is the rollback of environmental and indigenous rights protections being led by the country's president, Jair Bolsonaro, at the behest of, or at the very least, for the benefit of the agribusiness industry primarily.
And we've reported before on how meat packers like JBS play a significant part in this. But your organization has been increasingly focused on the role U.S. banks and other firms play in financing this destruction. Can you explain what your organization found?
Big U.S. banks and asset managers like BlackRock, like JPMorgan Chase, like Citigroup and others are major bankrollers of the industry in the Brazilian Amazon. So while a lot of the companies that operate there, the JBSs, the Marfrigs, the Minervas, are Brazilian, a significant portion of the funding that they get to actually carry out those operations comes from U.S. financial firms.
Hmm. You mentioned BlackRock. BlackRock, the largest asset manager in the world, has been a big focus of yours. In 2018, Amazon Watch accused BlackRock of being the greatest causer of climate chaos. That is a bold charge.
It is a bold charge, but we stand by it. Not just Amazon Watch, but ally organizations like Friends of the Earth, like New York Communities for Change, many others have done research into the finances of BlackRock and where the investment dollars that it manages goes. And we've found that it is the biggest investor in fossil fuels and the biggest investor in deforestation risk commodities. And those are the two industries that are most responsible for climate change. And so we think that BlackRock has a huge responsibility here, particularly as it in the last year has really tried to position itself as a good climate actor.
Yeah. I mean, is there anything that comes from this last year? Your investigation was in 2018. CEO Larry Fink has been applauded for his commitment earlier this year to divest from coal. Do you think that Fink is genuine about moving the company in the right direction?
Well, I think we have seen some important changes. You mentioned the movement out of coal in certain of its funds and other small steps. So I think there is something to be applauded, but there's much more to be done. We really think that it's, among other things, absolutely necessary that BlackRock isn't claiming to be a great actor on climate change, but still marketing and creating and pushing funds to its clients that are chock full of forest destroying and climate destroying companies. So right now, you go to BlackRock, you say, I'm a new client, I want to invest my money, where should I put it? And the primary menu of funds that it gives you are climate unsafe. And we think it should be the opposite. We think that unless you are going to BlackRock and saying, I want to pour my money into everything that destroys the climate, that you should actually get options that aren't destroying the climate, that are climate safe.
Hmm. BlackRock's position is that the majority of its investments in the Amazon are passive exchange traded funds or ETFs that it claims it doesn't directly control. What do you say to that?
Well, that's exactly what I was just referring to, in the sense that there are a lot of decisions that BlackRock and other asset managers are making, even when they're putting clients' money in index funds. I actually don't like using the word passive fund because I think it's a misnomer, right? Because BlackRock is picking which indices to create funds to track. It is, in some cases, creating its own indices for boutique-type funds. It is deciding which funds to put before clients when they show up in the front door. And so I think there actually are a lot of decisions that are being made. And so I think passive is a misnomer.
Mm-hmm. Two former senior BlackRock executives have been nominated for appointments to President-elect Biden's administration. Brian Deese, former head of sustainable investing, to lead the National Economic Council, and Wally Adeyemo, former interim chief of staff to Larry Fink, to serve as deputy secretary of the Treasury. What's your feeling about this? Should they be confirmed? Do you see any opportunities for engagement with these appointments?
Well, I think that as a general rule, we should be wary of appointees and nominees who are coming directly from Wall Street. I definitely have some concerns that either of these folks will be willing to maybe go head to head with some of their former colleagues and friends at BlackRock and at other financial firms. And I haven't had direct interaction with Mr. Adeyemo, but I have had with Mr. Deese. And I must say that it doesn't leave me very optimistic, because really found him to be dismissive of the concerns of indigenous peoples from the Amazon and of the impacts of BlackRock's policies on impacted communities. And that's a real concern when we're talking about someone who's supposed to be a public servant, serving the American people, all of us, not just the wealthy few.
Moira Burse is climate and finance director for the nonprofit Amazon Watch. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much.
Even without a pandemic keeping you inside, odds are you'd be catching up on a lot of TV and movies over the holidays. There's never been more to watch or more streaming platforms to subscribe to. But believe it or not, there's going to be so much more next year. Giant companies such as Disney and Warner Brothers are adding to their arsenal, and smaller contenders like Discovery Plus are joining the fray. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now to talk about what's next in the so-called streaming wars as 2020 draws to a close. Hello, Eric.
Hi.
Are these companies expanding so much because the pandemic has created such a demand, or would they have done so anyhow?
Yeah, I think they would have done so anyhow. We knew a long time ago that Apple and Disney and Warner Media and NBC Universal were all going to be creating streaming platforms so that they could take these shows that they owned away from Netflix. But once the pandemic hit, it just made it even more obvious that they had to funnel more of their resources towards streaming and funnel more of their projects towards streaming. And different companies have handled that in different ways.
So let's look at how Disney's handling it. It announced it would spend up to $16 billion, with a B, dollars on new projects for its streaming services. We can hear a bit of a trailer for one of them now. It's a new show centered around a fan favorite supervillain, Loki.
You're taking me somewhere to kill me.
No, I'm taking you someplace to talk.
Where I lie, I don't like to talk.
But you do like to lie, which you just did. Because we both know you love to talk.
Donkey. Disney isn't the only one with big plans. Warner Brothers is going to be debuting all its 2021 movies on HBO Max at the same time they release to movie theaters. How much are these moves game changers?
Well, the Warner Brothers announcement was a huge deal. I think that's going to create an expectation amongst the audience that they will have quicker access to movies that are in theaters on streaming services. And I think that's why, one reason why so many people in the movie industry are angry at Warner for that move because they didn't really consult with them before they made this decision. And now it could be a seismic change in the window between a movie being at a theater and a movie being available on a streaming service.
Well, it seems like everybody's keeping an eye on Netflix, and Disney is streaming original material. It has in the works the Star Wars TV show Mandalorian, an immensely popular show. Disney announced many new Star Wars projects, including the upcoming film Rogue Squadron, and they teased it in this promotional trailer with the director, Patty Jenkins.
I grew up the daughter of a great fighter pilot, and every day I would wake up and go outside and look up and see my father and his squadron taking off in their F-4s. So when he lost his life in service to this country, it ignited a desire in me to turn all of that tragedy and thrill into one day making the greatest fighter pilot movie of all time.
And the clip, you could hear the Velcro there. It ends with Jenkins donning a space pilot outfit and walking toward an X-Wing, the iconic Star Wars ship. Do you think that Disney can replicate the success of The Mandalorian with projects like this one?
Well, it's interesting. So Disney actually announced, I think, something like 9 different Star Wars projects that would be on streaming and 2 movies, including the one that Patty Jenkins is working on. It seems like they developed a process with The Mandalorian. That could be a template that they could use to develop these other Star Wars series. Certainly, it seems like that streaming version of Star Wars is much more creatively exciting than some of the theatrical films that we saw. Disney's leaning into that, and they're creating more projects, and we'll just have to see how that goes.
Does this leave any room for smaller streamers like Discovery Plus? Can they compete with the big guys?
So if you're looking at these lesser-known streaming services like Discovery Plus, AMC has started one called AMC Plus, they will have to offer material that you can't get somewhere else. I think it's a situation where the consumer is actually going to have a lot of great material. You just can't let yourself be intimidated by all the choices you have out there. And you have to figure out a strategy that makes sense for sampling it all.
Yeah, I mean, it is intimidating. There are so many to choose from. And if you don't feel like churning out more money for yet another one, even if it's just a month subscription, what are you to do? What do you suggest?
Well, you know, I did a story a long time ago, a year ago now, about how to put together a streaming strategy. It's on NPR.org. So if you did a search on my name, Deggans, and then streaming strategy, and then NPR, you probably find the link. And I think my recommendation now is the recommendation I made back then, which is, you know, you generally have to find a couple of streaming services that might be your base camp, and then pick and choose the things that make sense to add to your little collection of streaming services. And if you find you're not watching something, you know, with a click of a button, you can stop the subscription and you're not paying for it anymore.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.